It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Our politicians have to get our votes to get into office, but it seems like once they get into office, we don't always like them so much. Recent polling from Gallup found that none of the top elected officials at the federal level have job approval ratings above 50%. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is the closest at 46%. House Speaker Mike Johnson is at 40%. President Biden, 39%. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell at just 27%. Here in Wisconsin, Governor Evers' job approval rating was above the threshold at 53% in Marquette Law School poll surveys last fall. When Senator Ron Johnson was reelected in 2022, his approval rating in polls was around 37%. And as Senator Tammy Baldwin runs for reelection this year, her favorability rating most recently sat at 40. So why is it that we elect and reelect politicians that we don't like? At least we tell pollsters we don't like. And has it always been this way? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think many politicians get low job approval ratings? Why do you think politicians with low approval ratings get reelected? Do these ratings matter? Do you think our politicians are less likable over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, where he directs the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here again.
Now, my gut says, Charles, hey, maybe in America we've never liked politicians so much, but has it always been this way, or have we seen politicians having, maybe even sustaining, higher approval ratings in past years?
No, we have seen sustained high approval ratings. We also see ups and downs, even for pretty popular presidents. But there was a major change that took place in presidential approval beginning in the George W. Bush term, continuing through part of Obama's term, and especially throughout the Trump and now Biden terms, where people are generally more negative, and especially if you're not of the president's party, you're extraordinarily negative.
Did it used to be that, okay, if I am a member of Party A, I might still look at that president from Party B and say, hey, I might not vote for them, but I approve of a lot of what they're doing. And I'll tell that pollster, yeah, I'm cool with them, even though they're not on my team.
There was a lot more of that in the Bill Clinton and earlier terms. It's always the case that partisans of the president's party like him better, no surprise, than out-partisans. But back in the Clinton years, out-partisans would give the president a 30% approval rating, maybe a 25, maybe a 35, sometimes a 40. But starting in the second term of George W. Bush, we saw Democratic approval drop below 10%. And stay there through the rest of his term. In Obama's term, except for the first and the last year, in the middle years, Republicans gave Obama less than a 10% approval. And with Donald Trump and now Barack Obama,
Joe Biden.
The out party has been generally below 10% approval. So that's quite a shift. We also used to see in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that when the economy and world affairs were going well, approval would go up with both in-party and out-party partisans. And when times were bad, it would drop across all partisan groups. Now we're seeing that very low approval from the out-party stay in single digits no matter what happens in the world, while the president's party are quite positive about him. So it's a greater divide and a greater translation of partisanship into approval.
Okay, it seems like this has got to mean something, this pretty significant change. I assume the word polarization comes in here somewhere. Charles, what's going on?
Yeah, polarization is the usual term. In political science, we also talk about it as negative partisanship. Mm-hmm. That we don't love our party so much more than we used to, but we've come to really dislike the other party much more. And you see that reflected in favorability measures towards the political parties, Democrat and Republican, but you also see it reflected in these very negative views of the other party's president when they're in office.
Charles Franklin is with us from Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School poll, talking about approval ratings for politicians, presidents, but not just presidents, and why they seem to have gone down over the years. You can join in with your questions, your theories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First of all, I think that even though we think that politicians are not that are honest, they turn out to be not honest. So something surfaces, and it's very discouraging. The other thing is, as a former teacher, some of the behaviors that I see these adults exhibiting are the exact behaviors I've seen in preschool and kindergarten, where we actually teach children how to get along and how to solve conflicts. And perhaps some of these politicians ought to take some lessons from that. And that's all I have to say.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. Charles, I think there's often been a perception over the years that politicians may not always be honest. Is that getting worse, though, over time? Is Elizabeth onto something that maybe part of the reason their approval ratings are down is politicians are less trustworthy?
Well, there's been a clear change in cynicism and lack of trust in politicians and in government. That goes back all the way to the 60s, but it's continued to come down year after year after year of people saying they simply don't trust the federal government to do what's right. And when it comes to candidates or elected officials, as Elizabeth said, you know, there's a sense of negativity about their performance, whether that's scandals that come up about each president or whether it's something else. There's also a little bit more of gloom and doom in the last 20 years than there was in the 80s and 90s. We see that with very high percentage, well over 60%, saying the country's headed in the wrong direction. And that wrong direction measure has sort of stayed there even as the economy's gotten better or gotten worse over the last 20 years in a way that it wasn't as negative in the 80s and 90s.
Thanks for that call. Lisa joins us now in Madison. Lisa, hello.
Hi. You know, I thought it was interesting that your guest was talking about a change in the second Clinton administration. And I think it was in 1990 when Newt Gingrich distributed a pamphlet to GOP politicians. The pamphlet was called Language, a Mechanism of Control. And they were given terms that when you were discussing Republican policies, they were very positive terms to include. And when you were discussing Democratic policies, it was very negative terms. And that has really gone on steroids in the last 5 years or so. But I think that was one of the initial trends, too, that we saw taking place in this issue.
Lisa, interesting. Charles, what do you think?
Yeah, I think in the late 90s, and that's the period when Gingrich was Speaker of the House and led the Republican seizure of control, or winning of control, I should say, in the 1994 elections, that we started to see a more conflictual politics. The Republicans had been out of power in the House of Representatives for decades. And in taking it back under Gingrich, you saw the success of those aggressive attacks from Republicans and Gingrich specifically. I think as the cable news media grew in the following years, in the early 2000s up till now, you see politicians finding that appearing on cable news or other kind of mass media outlets gives them a chance to light fires, if you will, to push their proposal in sometimes incendiary terms. And that seems to have helped the people that portray those kinds of policies, not hurt them. So as a result, we've also seen a more intense language, if you will, for politics and how we deal with the opponent. Certainly the old days that we look back wistfully on, when Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan could fight over policy during the day but get together for a drink in the evening, Democrat and Republican disagreeing on a lot, but also not letting that be a barrier to compromise from time to time. Those times have gotten much, much harder since the late Clinton years and throughout the 21st century.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Steve is with us now in Stevens Point. Steve, hello.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Steve?
Well, I just wanted to comment or I guess ask the question whether or not the sort of specialized niche news outlets and talk radio has sort of fueled the polarization that we see in today's politics. I often hear when I listen to one side of things how the other side hates America and wants to destroy the country. And as a former member of the military, I never felt that way about my fellow members of the military who might vote differently than I did. And I guess I was interested in your guest's comments on that.
Steve, interesting, the impact of partisan media outlets, Charles.
Yeah, I think there's no question that they have added to this, but they've done it by giving platforms for people to go and talk on. So if you go to more liberal channels, you'll hear an awful lot of criticism of Donald Trump. If you go to conservative outlets, overwhelming criticism of Joe Biden. I don't think that it's new in the sense that we've always had partisan media in this country. Go back more than 100 years to the Civil War, and you can see that. But it does, in the last 20 years or so, maybe a little more with the rise of AM talk radio, provided channels for ideological programming that found a receptive audience that was popular and that pushed the boundaries of what you could say and what kind of charges you could leverage. So again, I come back to the question of what are the positive talking points that politicians make today, as opposed to what are the negative talking points? And at least to my ear, we see an awful lot more of the negative talking points than of the positive talking points. Again, to go back to Ronald Reagan, Morning Again in America in his 1984 reelection campaign was an election campaign filled with optimism and hope. I don't see a whole lot of campaigns built on that optimism and hope these days.
Thanks again for the call, Steve. Charles Franklin is with us, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, talking about politician approval ratings and why so many elected officials are not well liked in polls and why that's in general gone down over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think drives up or down a politician's approval rating? Do you see a way to bring a politics back where somebody from one side could still like and respect someone from the other side? What do you want to hear from politicians and or the media and which media to help do that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Charles Franklin, law professor at Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School poll. We're talking about why many politicians, especially at the national level, have low approval ratings in polls, despite needing a form of approval in the terms of votes to get into office in the first place. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dawn is with us in Spring Green. Dawn, hi.
Hi. I was just calling to perhaps suggest a theory that one of the reasons the approval ratings go down once an individual is in office is because most people who run for office are successful at conning the voters. And the qualities that it takes to actually run and be elected for the job are not the qualities that it takes to successfully perform the job.
Interesting, Don. So the qualities of a good candidate and a good president or whatever job might be very different. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's certainly some element to that. It's also that those promises that are made during the campaign inevitably fall a little short when it comes to actually implementing them. If we go back all the way to Franklin Roosevelt, for example, we often see that when presidents first come into office, they do generally get a bit of a honeymoon period, a little period of higher approval ratings. But then over the next 3 years, their approval ratings tend to trend down, and that tends to happen regardless of who the president is. But in the fourth year, coming up on re-election, most of the presidents and those who win re-election see their approval ratings rise some in that fourth year after having come down in the second and third year. And then they sometimes start going down again after re-election. So there's this, the campaign really does boost the expectations and the hopes, only to then see it fall off some.
Thanks, Dawn, for calling in. Linda is with us now in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I want to comment because as a voter, you know, I go and I want this person to, whoever it is, do a really great job. But sometimes I think voters just don't understand what the people we put in office have to deal with, all the partisanship, and they want miracles sometimes, and it's just not going to happen. This is a slow-moving and very difficult system to maneuver.
Linda, thanks for the point. Charles, voter expectations out of line, and that may lead to some disappointment in the polling.
Yeah, I say bravo. I think that's an excellent point to make. Getting anything through Congress is hard under the best of circumstances. It's hard even when your party has complete control of both the House and the Senate, as was true under Donald Trump in much of his term, and has been a challenge for Biden since the Republicans took the House back in 2022. I think that challenge of having bargaining partners on the other side is the thing I would point to. Again, if we go back to Clinton or George H.W. Bush or Ronald Reagan, they all had Congresses, at least part of the time, where they had a willing negotiating partner, and they did pass bipartisan legislation. That's been harder in recent years.
Thanks again for that call. I wanted to follow up on that, Charles, because I think, you know, there's the thought that, hey, a good politician finds compromises and is willing to be that negotiating partner you were just mentioning. But that might hurt them with the key demographic, the core voters in their own party. Do we have measures of how maybe that kind of moderation or negotiating might actually hurt candidates, maybe even in a primary race?
Well, we have indirect measures of where the people within the president's party disagree with him. We're seeing that now with the divide over how to deal with Israel and Hamas and their conflict. We see it in the Republican Party, or have seen it, over trade and tariffs and things like that, where different elements of the party have very different views on those things. So internal divides are very real. But when it comes to passing legislation, you either need to command a large enough majority in both houses of Congress to push through your measures, or you need at least some bipartisan support to get most things through. That bipartisan support has become much harder as cooperation with the other party has come to be seen as dealing with the enemy rather than negotiating with a fellow American.
Time for another caller. Jim is with us in Appleton. Jim, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to point toward, Jim?
I think all of this constant hate between the two parties started with Rush Limbaugh. When Rush Limbaugh first started on the radio, he was entertainment. He criticized, you know, the tree huggers and all of that. But when Clinton got into office, it just turned to rabid hate. You know, he just hated him with a passion. And if you were a Rush Limbaugh fan, you wouldn't do anything with a Democrat. There was no compromise. You know, and I think it's just escalated ever since he started.
Jim, thanks for the call. We're back again to the Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich era, and a figure like Rush Limbaugh. Charles, can one media figure like that, do you think, make that big a difference?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that Limbaugh transformed talk radio as a format, and especially AM talk radio on the conservative side. I think more broadly, listen to the rhetoric of elected officials or radio hosts, and it's fairly rare to find the ideological media being willing to give much credit to the other side, or good faith working with the other side. That's not what draws readers or viewers.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. In our last minute or so, Charles, we see politicians with approval ratings in the 30s and 40s winning re-election sometimes. So approval is one thing. Getting the votes you need to get past the finish line is another. What do you think makes that difference?
Well, part of it is you're running against somebody else who's also not very well liked. In our current polling, we show Biden with a 40% favorable rating, Trump with a 42% favorable, and 20% to 25% are unfavorable towards both of them. But if those are the two primary candidates next fall, then people will be forced to make a choice. I also have to say that Republicans like Donald Trump a lot. 70% of Republicans are favorable towards him in our polling, but 80% of Democrats are favorable to Joe Biden in our polling. So while there's a lot of dislike about both of them, that comes especially from the out party and maybe, unfortunately, also from independents who are negative towards both of them.
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, where he directs the Marquette Law School poll. He was with us today to talk about political approval ratings and why many politicians aren't well-liked, and why the negatives tend to be higher than they used to be over time. Still time for you to share your ideas, maybe your hopes that things can get better. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Last semester, the University of Wisconsin-River Falls campus mourned the deaths of four students who died by suicide. Unfortunately, this is part of a bigger trend in Wisconsin and beyond. Rates of anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation among college students have been on the way up for years, and the COVID-19 pandemic made things even worse. Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among college students. Universities around the country are working to find solutions, and we'll check out some of those solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a college student or recent graduate? What have you seen on your own campus when it comes to the mental and emotional well-being of the students there? Do you see help being accessible from school counselors or support groups? What kind of resources would be most meaningful to your mental health as a student? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. By the way, if you're struggling with thoughts of suicide, you can call 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. You can also text the word HOPELINE to 741-741 to reach a free and confidential crisis text line. We'll repeat that info in just a bit. Laura King is Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs and Strategic Enrollment at UW-River Falls. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm sorry for the losses on your campus. Can you just start by talking about how people are doing there? What's the mood on campus after that obviously very difficult semester?
Yeah, so the last semester was really tragic. And I would say it really hit all of us very, very hard. We started classes, we're 1 week into our new semester. And so we are looking forward while still making sure to grieve those that we've lost. And we're really focused on making sure that our students are doing okay. And really focusing in on the mental health needs of our students, our staff, and our faculty.
And what kind of thing, what does that look like? What kind of things is the campus providing for students and staff and faculty to try to deal with those mental health needs?
Sure. So we're really focused on trying to make sure that we have the supports in place. So like many campuses, we have a student health and counseling center. So making sure that that team is full and working hard to make sure they're connecting with students. We're expanding some of the work that we're doing. We're bringing a peer-to-peer group to campus called Active Minds. And so our counseling team is working to bring that group to our campus. So we don't only just have that staff to student support, but also that peer-to-peer support. And then we're also doing things like trying to highlight resources that we have on campus. With Mental Health Mondays. So we'll have a few of those throughout the semester. And then we're partnering with different organizations, trying to make sure that we're moving forward and advancing some of the work we're doing on campus, really with students at the center of the work that we're doing.
I mentioned those statistics that seem to suggest that college students and people of that age are experiencing some mental and emotional health difficulties. It seems like maybe one bright spot is, my understanding, Laura, is that more recent generations are more willing to talk about these issues and open up and share these concerns. Is that something you see from your students at UW-River Falls, a willingness to talk about issues where maybe previous generations might have clammed up about it?
Absolutely. I think that that's really an important point. I think one of the first steps is really making sure that we're creating spaces and opportunities for students to talk about it and to really destigmatize mental health. That's what we're trying to do here. And we found that many of our students are very willing and open about their mental health needs, as well as concerns that they may have. And I think that's really a good thing because you're right, in the past it had been much more stigmatized, and we need to start normalizing, talking about mental health, about suicide prevention, postvention work to make sure that we're here to support each other when we need it.
And Laura, having gone through this horrible situation at UW-River Falls, and you're still recovering from that, that said, are there lessons you might suggest to other institutions, maybe small colleges, campuses around the country, or other organizations who think, yeah, that could just as easily have been us?
Sure. I would say one thing is, know that as an institution, you're not alone. This was a situation that we never thought that would happen at River Falls. And when we were going through it and continue to go through it, we found an outpouring of support from other institutions, from those within our system, from outside our institution, individuals who I believe you'll speak with a little next, mm-hmm. From the Jed Foundation, have been amazing collaborators, soundboards, individuals to really help support that network. And so I think that's something that I would say is really important, is to make sure that we're openly talking about suicide prevention and postvention work and working together, because the resources and the individuals are out there to support you, and you can tap into those.
Laura, thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much to talk about this important topic.
That's Laura King, Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs and Strategic Enrollment at UW-River Falls. She was with us to talk about student mental health as the campus community mourns the death of four students who died by suicide last semester. Our next guest specializes in rural school mental health and youth suicide prevention. He's here to talk more about the unique mental health challenges faced on college campuses and how communities and institutions can help. Kurt Michael is an emeritus professor of psychology at Appalachian State University, senior clinical director of the Jed Foundation, which Laura just mentioned. That's a nonprofit that supports teen and young adult mental health. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I understand the Jed Foundation works a lot with postvention, intervention after something happens on a campus, as we've seen at UW-River Falls. What are some of the first steps you'd like to see from a campus in that situation?
Yeah, great question. And let me just also say that the Jed Foundation, that's now in its 25th year, really was founded based on these principles of postvention that I'll talk about in a minute. And just to mention for your listeners, the Jed Foundation is named after Jed Satow, who lost his life to suicide in 1998. And really his parents, Donna and Phil Satow, deserve credit for in their grief starting the foundation to create a much more comprehensive safety net for college students specifically.
And so with that in mind, what would a postvention look like? What kind of things, and I understand you are working with UW-River Falls yourself right now, what kind of priorities do you have at the top of your list?
Yeah, there's a series of priorities. I think if I can explain maybe the three top priorities of postvention response, the first is just to help people in the community heal from suicide loss. That's number one, to do whatever is possible to reduce the possible negative effects of suicide broadly, and to ultimately prevent suicide, especially for those who might be identified as being at higher risk.
And I think sometimes we're reluctant to talk about suicide even after it's happened for fear that, okay, we're gonna put that idea in somebody's mind, right? And I understand the research says, no, that's not exactly how it works. How do you address that?
Yeah, what a great point. That is an often sort of an assumption that people have, that somehow if you ask about it directly, it's going to create a dangerous situation and a risky situation. And actually, we find the opposite to be true, that a lot of folks really appreciate when you ask directly, when somebody's thinking about suicide, they appreciate the transparency and the honesty. And usually it's very much protective. That is, that once that conversation starts, then efforts to reduce that particular risk can then come into play. And that's what we found after years of studying this, that much to our surprise, asking directly actually is protective.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Elliot is with us in Beloit. Elliot, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to tell us about Elliot?
Yeah, I just wanted to inform you. I actually, this conversation is very personal to me because I am young and also have mental health struggles myself with depression and anxiety. And I'm actually faculty at one of the technical colleges in the state. And, you know, I just want to make this point of regarding mental health care and services in the state at education institutions is right now, one of the biggest things that I see is we have so much of a focus and so much, you know, incredible work just trying to talk about it more. But the real sad reality and truth is that money and funding and resources are not going to these places in the ways that they really need to be. Things like, you know, at our college, we only have like a few people who are, you know, trying to handle this whole giant task of trying to balance the well-being of everybody on our campus, you know, and they are stretched very thin every day. And I guess part of what I want to call about is just a call to action, especially to other faculty people like me who work at colleges, and acknowledge that the real thing is we are the first people that see our students every day, you know, and we are the ones that actually see them the most. And so we have a responsibility to know the resources that are available, to, you know, be empathetic, to listen, to be kind. And this is not just an issue of the students, it's an issue of your colleagues as well.
Elliot, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there to talk about, Kurt. First of all, Elliot raises the resource issue. He sees not enough on his campus. Is that pretty common?
It is common, and I share his sentiments, not only as a provider, but a member of a faculty for 23 years, knowing that there's considerable burden on faculty and staff to, I would say, and summarizing the concerns, you know, adequate help for helpers. And again, we want to make sure that we're trying to make that possible to the greatest extent we can. And I know that funding is always a concern. So accessibility to services remains a top priority of the Judd Foundation and of organizations, campuses, just like River Falls.
And Elliot also brings up the idea of making sure that faculty and maybe other staff who have direct contact with students have training in being sort of a first responder in some ways, or a first point of contact for mental health concerns. I could see somebody saying, I'm here to teach chemistry or whatever. I don't know how to deal with these life or death issues with people. What are your thoughts on that idea from Elliot?
Yeah, no, it's an important point that Elliot raises. I guess that oftentimes the challenge is there, if there's limited resources for the services themselves, that's one of the things that will probably get the short end of the stick would be proper training for faculty and staff. And so again, it's one of those gaps that we need to get better at addressing. So I share those concerns, absolutely. Also don't want folks to feel some excessive pressure to behave like a mental health professional if they don't feel like they've been sufficiently trained. So trying to strike that balance, if you will, that we can still teach chemistry and be supportive without feeling pressure to be professional mental health counselors, if that makes sense.
Elliot, thanks again for that firsthand perspective. Kurt Michael is with us, Senior Clinical Director of the Judd Foundation. That's a nonprofit that supports teen and young adult mental health. Talking about suicide prevention and mental health resources on college campuses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see, if you are in a college community or have been recently, do you see mental health concerns about suicide as a problem on that campus? Do you feel like there are resources out there? What more would you need? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Kurt Michael, Senior Clinical Director of the Judd Foundation, about mental health among college students. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Kurt, we heard from Debbie in Madison, who asks, what do we know about the root cause of why suicides seem to be up in college students? You hear a lot of things on social media, Debbie says, but what's really going on? What are your thoughts, Kurt?
So if you kind of look at the trends over time, you notice a few things. One is that over the past 20 years, according to the CDC, suicide rates have steadily risen over that span. In some cases, at a faster rate in certain high-risk groups more than others, for example. But I do think that the issue has been ongoing for some time. So this is not a new issue by any stretch. I would also comment that the good news is that a lot more people are receptive to help seeking. So I think being able to talk about it openly is something that's more normative nowadays. But also to mention that we want to, you know, raise the bar in our efforts to promote prevention by being aware of people who might have early warning signs of suicidality, that is, suicidal thoughts. And so in a recent study that was published in the Archives of Suicide Research in 2022, the estimate across the United States was that during that year, about 16 million people reported experiencing suicidal thoughts. So it's a pretty common concern that we want to, when we're able to provide intervention, when we first learn of someone's complaints or concerns around suicidality, that can be addressed ideally early in the course of some evolving situation, if that makes sense.
And we're talking about campuses, Kurt, and I mentioned earlier suicide, one of the top causes of death among college students. Looking at CDC numbers, it's also one of the top causes of death among college-age people, period. How much of this is right, something about this age cohort versus something specific to campuses?
Well, I don't know that we can ever really identify any kind of clear pattern or contributing factors. I think what we're seeing is a complex interplay of these factors that things like COVID or academic stress or relational stress, those kinds of things are pretty common among that those age groups. And so we want to be mindful about how these things interact. And I would add one more important factor, which is access to lethal means. So trying to do what we can to reduce access to particular lethal means that can be very protective.
Time for one more caller. Beth is with us in Madison. Beth, hi.
Hi. I'll keep it short. And this is how we managed with our own college students and our family. We encouraged our adult children to keep their school load down to 3 courses per semester for reasons that were very important to us. And that was to enable them to succeed no matter how long it takes to graduate. I think that young people feel the need to take more load than that. And then there are also to encourage family and friends to refrain from comments that would question how long it takes to graduate. That's a common difficulty, I believe, for young people, and they feel that pressure when they hear little comments, no matter how well intended.
That's interesting, Beth. Thanks for the call. And it's very interesting, Kurt, because I think there's a lot of focus in Wisconsin and I assume elsewhere to try to get students graduated in 4 years or 2 years, depending on the program. That might be putting on pressure to take more classwork than Beth thinks is healthy. How much of a factor do we see in that academic pressure to get a lot done and get it done this semester?
Yeah, I think that's certainly case by case and can be very relevant for individuals. And I think that really is important to come up with a sensible, sensitive plan for each person to accomplish their goals within a reasonable time frame. So, yeah, I think for some, those perceptions of increased academic stress can contribute. But I do think it's individually dependent. So I think the caller's points are good ones.
Beth, thanks a lot for the call. Kurt, we were earlier talking about the postvention, right? How a campus reacts to a tragedy, a suicide on campus. What kind of things, apart from that, maybe before that event happens, can a campus community do to have a better attitude, to have a better mental health attitude in the community?
So I think, one of the ideas would be to be preemptive in communication strategies, messaging around where help is available, offering messages of support, recovery, and resilience are often key messaging components that I think are protective. And so we want to help campuses create conditions where if these particular stressors become, too much or overwhelming or might contribute to someone's risk for suicide, that there's sufficient support discussed about as much as you can in advance so that people can know this going in to their experience, maybe including some of these, messaging around orientation time or when people first arrive on campus could be a strategy that you basically look at postvention as an opportunity for prevention, if that makes sense.
Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kurt Michael, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Appalachian State University, Senior Clinical Director of the Jed Foundation, a nonprofit that supports teen and young adult mental health. He joined us for a look at how campuses and communities can support suicide prevention and mental health resources for college students. This after suicides at UW River Falls last semester. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline can be reached by calling 988. That's 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, or you can text HOPELINE to 741-741. Tomorrow on the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, a look at police presence in schools and research on the impact it can have. That's tomorrow morning on the Ideas Network. Apparently, there's a thing going around on social media now, TikTok in particular, with a test of true love. The test asks your significant other to peel an orange for you. If they do, that's good. If they don't, well, it's bad. Okay, I have no problem with goofy stuff like this, as long as it's done in fun and recognized as not having any, you know, scientific value. Like, no, my problem is that's not how I eat oranges. A, I usually use citrus in beverages, so I squeeze it, I don't peel it. And two, if I do eat an orange, I just cut it into quarters, and then I jam a quarter of the orange in my mouth, get all the stuff, take the peel out, like that. The only thing that proves to my significant other is that I'm kind of embarrassing when it comes to table manners. But she knew that right from the start. Orange, you glad to know that? This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll explore why the world seems to be seeing more armed conflict right now than it has in some decades and what it means for us here in the U.S. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Winter has a way of wearing you down, but there are ways to get by. Producer Steve Gotcher has found one way to cope.
Winter can take its toll on your mind. The walls close in, the sky is gray, and the snow piles up. Every morning, you bundle up, scrape the windshield, crank the heat, trudge to work. Then the call comes.
Hey, Steve, it's John. Want to play a little poker Saturday night around 7:30? Give me a call and let me know if you're in. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
That call means there's a reason to keep going, if only until Saturday. Yep, it's poker on Saturday night. But this isn't just any poker game. It's all about the location. From the street, the house on Madison's Near East Side looks like all the rest, but a short walk down the narrow drive to the tiny backyard reveals an unexpected scene. Christmas trees snatched from the curb are arranged in the deep snow surrounding a 12 by 14 foot canvas cabin tent. A short path has been shoveled to the zipper that opens the flaps. Nearby, bottles of beer poke out of the snowbank. Candle lanterns light the backyard, and a warm glow emanates from the kerosene lanterns inside. Smoke curls from the stovepipe, poking out of the roof. Inside, a large wood stove puts out ample heat and warms every corner. An old toboggan sitting on crates holds a lantern, a few half-full whiskey bottles, and an assortment of cups and glasses. There's an old dining room table and chairs with a couple of lanterns, some bowls of chips, and a deck of cards in the middle of the tent. People filter in and take their place at the table, each with a container full of change and a beverage of choice. The smell of kerosene, wood smoke, and canvas permeates as our eyes adjust to the lantern light.
All right, what do you say?
Let's play poker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Want to cut? Okay, we're going to do a seven-card stud.
John, our host, deals the first hand, and everyone throws in a quarter, the maximum bet, as cards get dealt around the table. Five-card draw, seven-card stud, between the sheets, guts, Texas Hold'em, seven-card no-peek. Each new dealer picks their favorite game.
For that, I'll bet a quarter. I just put in a quarter.
Thanks for the prompt.
You put a quarter in, right?
Yes, I okay, did. I did, absolutely.
Just keeping these guys honest.
Yeah, you need to.
It's easy to play if you don't have to put any money in.
As the game progresses, the city melts away, and you can imagine that the tent is somewhere in the deep woods, far away, where no one can find you. The mood is easy, and the cares of the outside world are forgotten for now. Table talk flows from the weather to how are the kids doing, what's up at work, and how much is that current bet? It's an evening of pleasant conversation with moments of deep concentration as players contemplate whether to bet or fold. The excitement grows with the pot until someone lays down the winning hand and rakes in the small pile of change in the center of the table. A night of poker in the tent with the snow, the discarded Christmas trees, and the wood heat is a transcendent experience. It's a great escape from the icy cold of winter while embracing it at the same time.
Really? On that Jack 10, huh?
I'm gonna step out on this.
Wow.
Look at that.
Just like that.
I'm always delighted when I get the call that there will be poker on Saturday night.
All right.
But right now, there's time for one more hand. And that's a good thing, because baby needs new shoes. Well, don't let your deal go down. I never let your deal go down. Well, don't let your deal go down. Till your last old dollar's gone. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
This is Central Time. The last 2 years have seen more armed conflict around the world since at least the Cold War. That's according to data from the Uppsala University Conflict Data Program in Sweden. Their research shows that the number of conflicts and fatalities has risen significantly in recent years after a period of relatively low conflict through the 90s and 2000s. The wars in Ukraine and Gaza might come to mind first, but the largest drivers of recent global conflict are state and non-state actors in Africa and in South and Central America. Those conflicts that don't involve the U.S. directly aren't always in the headlines, but widespread fighting and unrest around the world have the potential to affect everyone in a global society. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about an apparent rise in global armed conflict? What do you think might be behind that? Do you see impacts of this violence even when the U.S. isn't directly involved? Do you see the U.S. having a role in arbitrating, preventing these kind of conflicts, responding to them? If so, what role? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He specializes in topics including armed conflict, international relations, and terrorism. Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
I think looking at the news often, you can have this perception that things are always getting worse, but this research from Uppsala University in Sweden seems to say, yeah, this is the real deal. Do you see, from where you're standing, a general increase in conflict around the world?
I don't think so, actually. I think we have to be careful to avoid overinterpreting small fluctuations in the level of conflicts, the number of conflicts, or number of fatalities. Obviously, any conflict, any fatality is terrible and tragic for the people directly involved. But in terms of an overall picture, a bird's eye view, they caution people against overinterpreting minor fluctuations in the stock market and trying to base your investment portfolio on that. And I think the same thing applies to conflict data. There's a lot of randomness there. And if you break it down by different regions, by different actors, I think the story becomes much more of specific stories in particular places and not a sort of overall general upsurge in conflict as a whole.
And that actually led right into my next question, the idea that, you know, maybe there isn't a generalized cause here, that we just happen to be seeing bad things happen at around the same time. What are some of the things that that could cause a more fundamental problem that you say we're not seeing now? Are there things that you might watch for and say, aha, that is a potential driver of conflict in the future?
Well, I mean, there's some big trends in world politics that people have talked about that one might associate or think might have some impact on conflict. I mean, there's two I could think of in particular. One is the overall U.S. foreign policy position and the extent to which it's more internationalist or more isolationist, in the sense that the United States has traditionally tried to be involved in the world politics, tried to mediate conflicts here and there, and in many cases participated either by supplying one side or the other or by getting involved directly, as in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think we're in a period of retrenchment from that. I think Donald Trump is the most obvious symptom of that, and the Republican Party has become much more sort of returned to its isolationist roots from the old days. But I think that's more broadly shared in America as well, that people don't want to be involved in foreign conflicts as much anymore. However, I'm not sure that that's really responsible for any particular conflict you can identify around the world. It's possible that that might lead to conflict eventually, but I'm not really sure that you could assign the Ukraine war, for instance, to that or any conflict in Africa. Basically, the United States was never very active in trying to prevent conflict in Africa anyway. And so I think United States foreign policy, there's a danger of solipsism, I think, in the United States, of thinking that everything revolves around us and we are the indispensable nation. We have to be involved everywhere all at once. But I think a lot of the world gets along just fine without us for the most part. And we don't have to be involved everywhere. And we aren't, and conversely, where we aren't involved isn't necessarily a disaster or fantastic one way or the other. There are local causes for a lot of these things.
I want to look at a couple of those local issues. Now, we've got, of course, the Russian invasion in Ukraine. And in the meantime, we've got the conflict flaring up between Armenia and Azerbaijan, a place usually or in the past policed for better or worse by the Soviet Union and then by Russia. One argument has been, Russia's been distracted by its invasion of Ukraine, and that's opened the door for a conflict. In that particular case, do you see a spillover effect there?
Sure, you could make that argument that Russia supported Armenia for a long time and helped dampen Azerbaijani desires to retake that region of Nagorno-Karabakh, where there were ethnic Armenians living inside the borders of Azerbaijan. And as you say, Russia has certainly got its hands full with the Ukraine war at this point. I think Armenia also did some things to alienate Russia as well. And then but I think the fundamental cause of the conflict is that there's this territorial dispute between the two countries. There's mixed populations. You have Armenians living inside Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh, and you've got some Azerbaijanis living inside this region of Armenia as well. And you have the two sides, so the two sides have demands on each other, and the relative power balance shifted between them. And Azerbaijan went through a period of rearmament and rebuilding their military forces, and that was just not matched on the Armenian side. And so the balance of power shifted in favor of Armenia, and so Armenia attacked and successfully took over Nagorno-Karabakh, actually with relatively few fatalities, relatively little conflict. It was actually quite fast. And so it wouldn't even show up in any of these bigger graphs of conflict fatalities over the years, because it was such a short conflict.
Another area people here in the U.S. are watching closely, I think, is in the Middle East. We've got the Hamas attack in Israel, the Israeli invasion of Gaza in response, and concerns, and this is, I think, still an open question now, concerns that it could spill over with attacks in the Red Sea, Iranian-backed militias attacking U.S. troops. The idea that, there could be a wider spread, that this won't be contained to Gaza. What do you watch for to see if, in fact, that will happen?
Yeah, I think that's a very important case, and it's definitely a case where the United States could become directly involved because of our links with Israel on one side and because of our interests in the Persian Gulf and in the free flow of especially oil, but also other goods through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. So that's definitely someplace where American interests are engaged. So there could be conflict there. I think the question is, how far are the Iranians willing to push it on behalf of Hamas? And my guess is that the answer is not very far, that these sorts of small-scale attacks on shipping are designed to be under a certain threshold, which would provoke a large-scale American retaliation. The Iranians have things to worry about, right? If the Iranians are basically, essentially, gone back to their program of developing nuclear weapons, and they know there's a lot of people in the United States who are not happy about that, and a lot of people in Israel as well. And the possibility of an American all-out strike to destroy those nuclear facilities is not impossible. It's not likely, but it's not impossible. So they need to stay under a certain threshold to try to avoid that sort of large-scale reaction by the United States. I think that will help keep it damped, but on the other hand, we've already seen it expand to the north. Hezbollah, also supported by Iran, has been attacking Israel. So it's much bigger than it was. And so in a sense, Hamas's gamble has paid off to a certain extent. They've really ignited a larger scale fire and made it much more difficult for the Arab states to establish diplomatic relations with Israel over the heads of the Palestinians as they were engaged in doing before. So there's a real danger there for sure.
We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor Andrew Kidd about an international report on an uptick in armed conflict around the world, but he says that may just be statistical variation, not an underlying fundamental cause making things overall worse. Local stories instead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role, if any, do you think the U.S. should play in armed conflicts between other countries, within other countries, and maybe non-conventional things, maybe things driven by gangs, as in Haiti and Central America, by drug cartels, as in Mexico? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We'll continue our talk with Andrew Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison, who studies political violence and international relations. He's with us today to look at a recent report from a group that tracks international violence and conflict, seeing an uptick. He says no major fundamental change, nothing driving an overall thing, but local variation, local stories. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the U.S. role, if any, in various kinds of international conflict. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Barry joins us now in Madison. Barry, hi.
Hello there. I would like to, well, Dwight Eisenhower said in his final speech that we must be cautious of the military-industrial complex, as so many people know. And I would like the guests to address how the military industry in the major five countries that provide most of the weapons for the world, how much does their military-industrial complex influence the country's international relations?
I gotcha, Barry. A lot of background noise there. But this is an argument we hear sometimes, Andy, that the arms industry, in effect, drives conflict to be more common. What are your thoughts for Barry?
So in general, I don't really think that's a major factor in driving conflict. I think in a broad sense, if we didn't have a strong military industry, we obviously wouldn't be selling weapons abroad because we wouldn't have them to sell. So in that sort of, almost tautological sense, that's true. But I don't put any stock in theories which argue that American military contractors are somehow fomenting war to increase their profits, or that U.S. Military officials are fomenting wars in order to increase the profits of defense contractors that they hope to get jobs in, the so-called revolving door thesis. I think that's a little bit far-fetched. I think the United States gets involved in wars, for good or ill, smartly or stupidly, because it believes that it has either security interests at stake, as in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when they thought, mistakenly as it turned out, that Iraq was pursuing weapons of mass destruction and had ties with terrorism. And the same thing in Afghanistan in 2001. These may be mistaken judgments, but I don't think they're sort of, surreptitiously motivated for the most part. I'm not a big fan of those explanations.
Barry, thanks for that call. Andy, I want to spend a few minutes on another type of conflict. In Mexico, here in the U.S., there's concern about Mexican drug cartels producing fentanyl, smuggling them across the border into the United States. There's been talks from some Republicans in Congress and in the presidential campaign of some form of military action targeting the cartels and their fentanyl production facilities. Can you talk about that type of conflict and your thoughts on what the U.S. could and should do when it comes to Mexico?
Well, I think the ideas that have been floated about actual military intervention in Mexico are catastrophically bad and not intelligent at all. I mean, the worst thing you could possibly do is to get American forces involved in Mexico in the drug wars. in any way at all, because that would immediately give the Mexican cartels an incentive to try to infiltrate, subvert, do all kinds of things to the American military itself and to the broader American society. And that's the last thing on earth you want, and it's certainly the last thing that would be effective in that regard, right? If the fighting against drug cartels is not primarily a military problem. It's a problem of force, yes, but it's a governmental problem. It's a problem of governance in that society. And the United States has shown itself to be appallingly bad at setting up effective functioning governments in formerly anarchic areas such as Afghanistan and even in Iraq, which Iraq had an effective government before we destroyed it. And then we tried to set up another one, which has had mixed success subsequently. But the idea that we're going to go into Mexico and use military force to somehow solve the drug problem is just beyond idiotic. I can't believe people are talking about that.
What would you see as a diplomatic option to work with a government that may or may not want to cooperate with the United States at any given time? And Mexico could be on that list. Central American countries dealing with gang problems, climate change problems, things like that. Do you see an effective role where the U.S. can work with those governments short of using military force?
Sure. There's plenty of room for diplomacy, of course, as the first line, for foreign aid, things like that, projects of that nature. And there's also sort of the elementary aspect of just getting better control of the border, right? It's kind of surprising to me that the Biden administration has waited so long to seize control of the border, not just because it needs to be done for its own sake, but because it's fueling the rhetoric of his likely opponent, Donald Trump, in the next presidential election. So if you've got people pouring across the border in their thousands in this uncontrolled fashion, then, you know, of course you're not going to be secure vis-a-vis drug traffickers and the rest of it. And so, not that I'm anti-immigration per se, but having some sort of secure of the border so that you decide who gets in, not, you know, Mexican gangs, would seem to be step one. And that's a purely defensive task. That's right. It's a task that could be accomplished by pursuing actions and strengthening forces on our side of the border where they belong.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at UW-Madison, where he specializes in armed conflict, international relations, and terrorism. With us today for a look at the state of conflict in countries around the world. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, low-income college students need help with the high costs of college. A new Wisconsin report makes the case for changes that would boost access to higher education. And a key U.S. funding bill on border security and aid to Ukraine and Israel may be stalled in Congress again. Presidential politics may be the biggest roadblock. We'll get the latest details in the effort to reach some kind of compromise. And as always, you can join in with your thoughts and questions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.